unreal. As one magazine noted, it would be hard to find anyone who has anything to say against Mrs. John D. Rockefeller, for the reason that Mrs. Rockefeller's life is almost wholly devoted to religious and benevolent work. She uttered only noble and uplifting thoughts, constantly thanked the Lord, and never stooped to gossip or flip remarks. Was this the case of another smart Victorian woman who felt trapped by the few options open to her, and took to bed and religion from boredom or self-defense? The social conventions of her day clearly approved of her decision to confine herself to church and home. But one wonders whether her cloistered religiosity wasn't a reaction to the mounting controversy surrounding Standard Oil. This gentle, brown-eyed woman adored her husband and believed implicitly in his goodness, but she was bothered by the charges hurled against him. We know from two of Rockefeller's colleagues that SETI sometimes wanted him to respond to attacks that he preferred to slough off and ignore. In the 1860s and early 1870s, Rockefeller wrote her confidential, highly informative letters about his business dealings, including the SIC. Starting in the 1880s, however, his letters suddenly became bland and empty, full of banalities about the weather and barren of business news. In general, Rockefeller kept his family apart from Standard Oil matters, with one curious exception. At the breakfast table, he sometimes read aloud samples from the reams of abusive crank mail that swamped his office. Perhaps he did this to make light of the threats or take the sting from controversy. Aside from this, he steered clear of anything even faintly controversial. Did SETI's religion become her impenetrable shield against the venomous criticism of her husband? And did John become more self-righteous about temperance and other social issues to assert his own virtue and assuage his conscience? These are intriguing questions, but ones avoided so sedulously by Rockefeller and his family that they left no comments that might shed any light on them. Certain aspects of Rockefeller's married life, those critical things whispered about Standard Oil in the privacy of the bedroom at night, will likely remain a mystery forever. Rockefeller always took umbrage at the accusation that he was a narrow workaholic, yet he didn't begin to travel abroad until after he had moved to New York and was well into his 40s. A stubborn provincial, he didn't hanker after the exotic, and he shunned Asia, Africa, Latin America, and other distant outposts serviced by Standard Oil. For him, the aim of travel wasn't to submit to the charms of an alien place, but to transport his culture there intact. He never traveled without a clergyman, typically Edward Judson or Augustus Strong, and a doctor, usually Hamilton Bigger, in tow, to cater to his spiritual and physical needs. Although Rockefeller never owned a private railroad car, the railroads hooked one up for him, as needed, to a transcontinental train for domestic trips. These plush carriages were divided into six compartments, including a kitchen, pantry, observatory room, private room, and staterooms. Streaking across the Great Plains, the family exuberantly sang hymns, or the children practiced their musical instruments. For an hour each morning, the clergyman led a Bible session, expounding another beatitude. In mapping his itinerary, Rockefeller ensured access to a Baptist church each Sunday, and he especially liked to drop in on black churches, often leaving a substantial donation in his wake. Most of all, he rejoiced to find a good, rousing tent meeting on the road. That was a real vacation treat for a man who always found religion an uplifting experience. In 1883, Rockefeller and Henry Flagler toured Jacksonville and St. Augustine, Florida, and reviewed the state's economic prospects with Dr. Andrew Anderson and tobacco mogul George P. Lorillard. The next year, the Rockefellers headed down to Atlanta, swung west to New Orleans, and wound up in Los Angeles and San Francisco. 2 years later, they made an extended trip to Yellowstone Park and returned by way of Chicago. By this point, even Rockefeller wondered whether he would ever escape the continental United States, telling Benjamin Brewster, "I may never get to Europe with my family, although we have been expecting we might go in a year or two. but I am very desirous to know more of this dear land in which we live. Deliverance came on June 1, 1887, when Rockefeller and his family set sail for a three-month European vacation, the Standard Oil executives trailing after them on a tugboat to wave goodbye. They must have been relieved because they feared that his indefatigable exertions at Standard Oil might injure his health. It took Rockefeller time to shed his obsessive concern for Standard Oil and allow himself to be lulled by the restful sea spirit. While still 460 miles from Southampton, unable to stop wondering about oil, he broke down and wired George Rogers, "I find I already thirst for knowledge about the business." A month later, he pleaded from Berlin, "Can't you glean more of interest from executive committee for me about current business? Am anxious for every scrap of information." After the Civil War, so many Americans flocked to Europe for vacations, presenting a cavalcade of innocents abroad, that their showy vulgarity and bumptious patriotism were frequently parodied by contemporary writers. The Rockefellers must have struck the Europeans as a dry antiseptic family, somewhat awkward and ill at ease with foreign languages. Rockefeller made no concessions to the European milieu, which only accentuated his homespun style. In London, he booked a hotel room in Piccadilly that gave his family a front-row seat for Queen Victoria's Jubilee, and they stared agog as she whisked by in a magnificent golden carriage. As the party crossed to France, John Dee was alert for sharp characters out to swindle him and prey upon his American innocence. Because he didn't speak French, he knew he looked like a vulnerable rube. At one point, he suspected, correctly, that their tour guide was fleecing them. Politely firing the man, he took charge of financial matters and pored over stacks of incomprehensible bills. Junior left a splendid vignette of his father trying to decipher a French check. "I can see him now, going over the long French bills, studying each item, many of them being unintelligible to him. Poulets," he would exclaim. "What are poulets, John?" Or again, "Bougies, bougies, what in the world is a bougie?" And so on down the bill. Father was never willing to pay a bill which he did not know to be correct in all its items. Such care in small things might seem penurious to some people, yet to him it was the working out of a life principle. Another traveling companion remembered the Rockefellers sitting in a private dining room in a Roman hotel as the paterfamilias dissected the weekly bill, trying to ascertain whether they had really consumed two whole chickens, as these slippery foreigners alleged. Mr. Rockefeller listened for a while to the discussion, and then said quietly, "I can settle that very easily. John, did you have a chicken leg?" "Yes." "Alta, did you have a chicken leg?" "Yes." "Well, Mother, I think I remember that you had one, is that right?" "Yes," said the mother. "I know that I had one, and no chicken has three legs. The bill is correct." I can still see the faces of that family group and hear the tone of Mr. Rockefeller's voice as he so quietly and so uniquely settled that dispute. As he grew older, Junior was deputized to handle tips and bills, which he later cited as excellent business training. Needless to say, Rockefeller spurned the European music halls and spent most of the trip making pilgrimages to churches or touring pretty scenery. At first he declined an audience with the Pope and yielded only when advised that it might please the Catholic workmen at Standard Oil. Still a man of exceptional fortitude, he and Junior went off for a vigorous mountain climb in Zermatt, Switzerland, and his stamina amazed his son. On this European trip, Rockefeller even found time to read, and grew enraptured in Paris by Lew Wallace's Ben-Hur and by Edward Bulwer Lytton's Last Days of Pompeii on a visit to Vesuvius. Yet he couldn't disappear into a reverie for long. He was now so famous that as he went from city to city, his arrival was celebrated in the local papers, and crank mail and begging letters began to follow him. So many letters piled up at hotels along the way that he finally had to purchase a big trunk just to carry them back. It was testimony to Rockefeller's thoroughgoing sense of responsibility that he preserved each letter for review at home. For a man who had fled to Europe for a peaceful interlude, it must have been startling to realize that his fame and notoriety were now so widespread in a world dominated by Standard Oil that he could no longer find refuge anywhere from his own reputation. Beleaguered by supplicants, Rockefeller tried to expand his disbursements to keep pace with his mounting income, and his donations nearly doubled from $61,000 in 1881 to $119,000 3 years later. Notwithstanding his somewhat frigid image, he took a close interest in the recipients of his charity and directly monitored their progress. Even as he was being reviled as a corporate malefactor in the press, this contradictory man agonized over the judicious application of his money, and found it harder to exercise scrutiny over charities than over business. In this seminal phase of Rockefeller philanthropy, the entire family judged the merits of applications, and the children sometimes audited important meetings. Once grace was said at breakfast, Rockefeller pulled out a folder stuffed with appeals from around the globe and assigned them to the children for further study. At this point, he drew no invidious distinctions among the children and involved all four equally in disposing of his fortune. Rockefeller's benevolent innovations have often been credited to his extraordinary philanthropic chief, Frederick T. Gates, who arrived on the scene in the 1890s. Yet by the 1880s, Rockefeller had already formulated certain core principles for his bequests, many of them stemming from beliefs he had long entertained as a businessman. For instance, like other industrialists, he worried that charity fostered dependence and pauperized recipients. After he had escorted his family to the notorious Five Points slum of Lower Manhattan on their first Thanksgiving Day in New York, he lauded a shelter for homeless men but carped at the policy of feeding all the tramps that came. "My impression is they only do it once a year. I would give them work and make them earn their food." Again, contrary to his stereotype, Rockefeller was acutely concerned about the poverty that accompanied industrialization, urbanization, and immigration in the late 19th century. Far from taking refuge in the world to come, he also stressed salvation in this world, prodding one clergyman to go into the midst of the multitudes thronging up and down the Bowery or thereabouts, and settle and stay right there with them, establish a church. Starting in 1882, he underwrote the ministry of Edward Judson, who exemplified his belief that a shepherd should abide with his flock. He was the youngest son of Adoniram Judson, a saintly figure among 19th-century Baptists, for converting the Burmese and translating the Bible into their tongue. Abandoning an affluent congregation in New Jersey, Edward Judson took over the Berea Baptist Church on Manhattan's West 15th Street to evangelize among poor Italian immigrants. As an exponent of the social gospel, which blended social work with spiritual comfort, he convinced Rockefeller to contribute to a fresh air and cool water fund, offering poor immigrants a refreshing 2-week retreat in the country each summer. As a regular dinner guest on 54th Street, Judson won over Rockefeller to his vision of a comprehensive religious center that would unite elements of both an urban church and settlement house, ministering to both the worldly and spiritual needs of congregants, a vision spectacularly realized with construction of the Judson Memorial Church on Washington Square in 1892. For this imposing edifice, designed in Greco-Romanesque style by McKim, Mead, and White, with stained glass windows by John Lafarge, Rockefeller contributed $40,000 of the original $256,000. Both a community center and house of worship, it offered a broad spectrum of services, from day nurseries to sewing classes for the poor. By this point, Rockefeller was indisputably the most powerful Baptist layman, and his largesse was already stirring fierce dissension in the ranks, not at all surprising in a denomination filled with working people. In the late 1880s, Judson told him about a convention of Baptist ministers in Philadelphia at which, Some very shallow and ill-advised vehement insinuations were made against the Standard Oil, prompting another clergyman to deliver a brave ringing speech in Rockefeller's defense. During the next two decades, this controversy grew more obstreperous as the Baptists tried to figure out whether the munificent oil mogul had been sent to them from heaven or hell. The most important concept Rockefeller bequeathed to philanthropy was that of wholesale giving as opposed to small scattershot contributions. As Cleveland's wealthiest philanthropist in the early 1880s, Rockefeller already felt oppressed by the appeals cascading in on him. In 1881, he apologized to Reverend George O. King of the Wilson Avenue Baptist Church in Cleveland, saying, "I have been holding back an answer in part from the fact that I had so many obligations for benevolent objects that I was almost overwhelmed." Since for Rockefeller the imperative to make money and donate money emanated from a common religious impulse, "I am more and more satisfied no member of a church can afford not to contribute as the Lord prosper him," he told a friend. He approached his donations with extreme gravity. In 1882, two of Rockefeller's interests dovetailed memorably in a commitment to a black women's school at a time when higher education for both blacks and women was held suspect. He had had a long-standing interest in education, having contributed for years to Denison University, a Baptist college in Ohio. In the 1880s and 1890s, he gave so open-handedly to A.C. Bacon's Indian University, today Bacon College, in present-day Oklahoma, that its first major building was named Rockefeller Hall. During the Civil War, Rockefeller gave to black ministers, churches, orphanages, and a deaf and mute society. He never relinquished a special solicitude for black welfare, quite atypical for a businessman at that time. Imbued with Baptist egalitarianism, he was ripe for conversion to a new cause when Sophia B. Packard and Harriet E. Giles re-entered his life. The Rockefellers had first met Packard and Giles on their honeymoon stopover at Oread Collegiate Institute, where the two women were newly recruited teachers. They were absorbed in the dismal plight of poor blacks, partly as an extension of their Baptist evangelism. After the Civil War, Baptists had been in the vanguard of forming churches for freed slaves and teaching them to read the Bible, and had enjoyed the strongest growth in the black community of any denomination. So when Packard was named corresponding secretary of the new Women's American Baptist Home Mission Society in 1878, she had a serviceable vehicle for advancing black education. When she and Giles toured southern black schools 2 years later, they were appalled by the educational facilities for black women and found one especially glaring omission. Georgia, with the largest black population, lacked a single institution of higher learning for black women. To rectify this, in 1881 they opened a school for young black women, many of them born under slavery and still illiterate, in the dank, dilapidated basement of the Friendship Baptist Church in Atlanta, christening it the Atlanta Baptist Female Seminary. The first class had 11 students, mostly mothers. For two sedate, decorous New England ladies to venture into the troubled area of Southern race relations represented a courageous act. In June 1882, Packard and Giles visited Cleveland to make an appeal to potential donors at the Wilson Avenue Baptist Church. For 40 years, the Spellmans had passionately backed abolitionism and sundry black causes. The recently deceased Harvey B. Spellman had sat on the executive committee of the American Freedmen's Union Commission. In consequence, Reverend King had a powerful hunch that the Rockefellers would respond enthusiastically to the pleas of Packard and Giles, and promised the two women that if they came to his church, he would deliver John and Setty Rockefeller in the audience. Packard and Giles dressed with the same spinsterish simplicity, but the similarities ended there. Tall and blue-eyed, Packard was a brisk woman with a ready wit and great managerial gifts, while the younger Giles seemed timorous, gentle, and retiring in manner. That evening they made an affecting presentation, summoning up images of the 150 students, many unlettered but eager, who crowded the drab church basement to learn. As rain dripped down the walls and gathered in stagnant pools on the muddy floor, Packard and Giles sometimes stood in puddles as they taught 11 or 12 classes apiece each day. Some classes were tightly wedged into a dusty area formerly used for coal storage. Breathing air thick with smoke and dust and ducking overhead heating pipes, the students had to kneel and write on wooden benches. To teach math, Packard and Giles laid sticks across the planks and had the students count them. At first, most of the women were provided with little more than a Bible, pad, and pencil, and the lighting was so poor that they couldn't read on rainy days. This poignant presentation would have wrung tears from a stone, and the Rockefellers were transfixed. As Harriet Giles recalled, "It was at that meeting that Mr. John D. Rockefeller first became interested in the school. After having emptied his pockets when the box was passed, he asked us the characteristic question, 'Are you going to stick?' and added, 'If so, I will do more for you.' On the spot, he pledged $250 more for their building fund. Much to the amazement of the teachers, he returned the next afternoon with 3 carriages and took them off to Forest Hill, where they drove about as honored guests. Inspired by these women, Rockefeller, though socially conservative, became unalterably committed to black education. As one chronicler of Rockefeller philanthropy has noted, "The Rockefeller files are more extensive on this subject of the welfare of the Negro race than on almost any other." More than any benevolent project, the Black Women's College in Atlanta became a Rockefeller family affair, as John was joined in his interest by his Spelman wife, sister-in-law, and mother-in-law. When it came to black education and welfare, Rockefeller displayed unwonted ardor. "Kindly assure the colored people of my sympathy for and interest in them, and tell them, I hope they will, in addition to securing knowledge from books, strive to learn to do all kinds of work, and better than any other class of men," he wrote to one minister friend in the late 1880s. Reciprocating the personal tone of his correspondence, Sophia Packard always saluted him as "dear brother" or "dear friend." Amid the hectic rounds of his life, Rockefeller always found time to send letters and small thoughtful gifts to Packard and Giles to buck up their morale. Rockefeller's involvement in the Atlanta school was at first cautious, but gradually acquired irresistible momentum. In late 1882, the Atlanta school bought 9 acres and 5 buildings that had housed Union occupation troops. By late 1883, the fast-growing school had enrolled 450 students, the mortgage on the barracks property was coming due, and the school wavered on the edge of fiscal crisis. At this point, Packard and Giles entreated Rockefeller for a donation to secure the school on a permanent footing. "Give it a name. Let it, if you please, be called Rockefeller College, or if you prefer, let it take your good wife's maiden name or any other which suits you." Although Rockefeller retired the $5,000 debt, he humbly declined to use his own name. Instead, in a fitting tribute to his in-laws, he opted for the Spelman name, thus giving birth to Spelman Seminary, renamed Spelman College in 1924. It developed into one of America's most respected schools for black women, counting Martin Luther King Jr.'s mother and grandmother among its many prominent alumni. On March 11, 1884, Rockefeller and his family went by train to Atlanta to celebrate the school's 3rd anniversary, and 450 students packed the chapel to glimpse their patrons. Rockefeller adored Negro hymns and spirituals and now heard them in abundance. After the opening hymn, Sophia Packard exclaimed, "I bless the Lord that I have lived to see this day." In a string of brief speeches, Seti Rockefeller paid tribute to the liberating power of song, Sister Lute memorialized their father's abolitionist work, and their mother told how the Spelman home had been a stop on the Underground Railroad. Though Rockefeller virtually never spoke in public, he delivered a talk of unaffected eloquence. It is in your hearts to make the school one that people will believe in. God will take these small beginnings to do a great work. I am thankful to be here." When Rockefeller sat down, it was announced, amid sustained cheers and hosannas, that the school had been renamed Spelman Seminary. As a paradigm of future Rockefeller philanthropy, several things about Spelman should be flagged for attention. In a delicate balancing act, Rockefeller gave enough to get projects underway, yet not so much as to obviate future fundraising. In 1886, Rockefeller Hall was dedicated, which included dormitory rooms and a beautiful chapel. During the coming years, he gave another 11 acres plus the money for additional dormitories, a laundry, a dining hall, and numerous other buildings, creating a lovely, elegant campus. Presented with architectural plans for one new building, he commented, "My suggestion is to err in getting what seems at present too much room rather than not enough. I judge the crop of colored folks will be large." In the 1890s, Rockefeller sent his own landscape architects to redesign the campus, and he himself selected the trees and shrubbery. Yet for all this fervent support, Packard and Giles had to struggle for years to keep the school afloat. With one check, Rockefeller might have relieved their anxiety forever, but he wanted to avert excessive dependence and keep alive a creative ambiguity about his intentions. While briefly serving on the Spelman Board of Trustees, he preferred to remain slightly detached and subtly enigmatic, never telegraphing his plans too far in advance. Another cardinal principle of Rockefeller philanthropy was to rely upon expert opinion. Many of his gifts to Spelman Seminary were channeled through Dr. Henry L. Morehouse, the field secretary of the American Baptist Home Mission Society, which increasingly functioned as a conduit for Rockefeller's wholesale philanthropy and education. Taxed by too many pleas for money, Rockefeller wrote to Morehouse on December 24, 1883, and inquired whether, to avoid having all these people from every part of the country calling on him, it might not be much better for the cause for him to give all through the Home Mission Society. Frederick T. Gates later took credit for this sane, efficient method of giving through umbrella groups that would then allocate money locally, but the idea had already taken root in Rockefeller's mind. In these early years, one also sees Rockefeller using contributions to stimulate collaboration from others, as he inched toward the concept of matching grants. For instance, in 1886, he pledged $30,000 to Morehouse, hoping that it would prove the catalyst for a $150,000 fund drive. Since Rockefeller believed in meritocracy, not aristocracy, he favored educational opportunities for minorities. Spelman Seminary taught nursing, teaching, printing, and other useful trades, but the focal point was training young black women for a good Christian life. Some of the first graduates went to the Congo as missionaries. As Packard and Giles told Rockefeller several years later, "God is blessing the school spiritually as well as temporally. A number of students have entered upon the Christian life since the term commenced. We believe the salvation of the race and our country depends upon the Christian training of these girls who are to be future mothers and educators." In the early years, Spelman Seminary encouraged a Victorian gentility among the students, turning out well-bred young ladies in hats and gloves. At the same time, it evinced much of the practical enterprising spirit espoused by Booker T. Washington, the principal of Tuskegee Institute in Alabama, who stressed vocational training for blacks. Before long, this approach to black education would be anathematized as futile and condescending by W.E.B. Du Bois and other critics who thought blacks capable of the same higher education as whites and felt they were doomed to mediocrity by vocational training. But whatever its early imperfections, Spelman College ultimately evolved into one of the most highly regarded institutions for black women in America. Chapter 14. The Puppeteer. Because Standard Oil had long exercised a global monopoly, Rockefeller's name was already known abroad. Foreign markets were larger and more lucrative than domestic markets. Some 70% of American oil went abroad in the mid-1880s. While some feeble competition managed to sputter on at home in the face of daunting odds. In the early 1870s, kerosene penetrated China, Japan, and other far-off spots, and one American traveler in 1874 saw standard kerosene flickering in the ancient quarters of Babylon and Nineveh. In the early 1880s, 85% of world crude oil production was still extracted from Pennsylvania soil, making it America's fourth largest export, and only Russian oil constituted a serious competitive threat. Since it made no sense to clamp down excess capacity at home only to see it expand abroad, Rockefeller could never tolerate foreign rivals, telling one colleague, "We have the capacity to do all the home trade as well as the export, and I hope we can devise ways and means to accomplish it later on. At all events, we must continue to strive for it." Standard Oil studied foreign markets and posted a cultivated oil merchant, William Herbert Libby, to the Far East in 1882 to make a 2-year survey. Observing that oil had found its way into more nooks and corners of the civilized and uncivilized countries than any other product in business history emanating from a single source, Libby proselytized for kerosene in Japan, China, and India. After translating into Chinese a pamphlet touting the safety of kerosene lamps, Libby had the satisfaction of seeing sampans laden with Standard Oil products floating up rivers deep in China's interior. To inflate demand, the combine sold hundreds of thousands of cheap lamps and wicks, and sometimes distributed them gratis along with the first kerosene purchase. "In many countries," said Rockefeller, "we had to teach the people to burn oil by making lamps for them. We packed the oil to be carried by camels or on the backs of runners in the most remote portions of the world. We adapted the trade to the needs of strange folk." For a time, Standard ruled foreign markets no less dictatorially than domestic ones, and with crude oil found in large quantities only in western Pennsylvania, it seemed this idol might last forever. Then this fool's paradise was roughly shattered in the early 1870s by a giant scramble for oil at the Russian port of Baku on the Caspian Sea. For more than a century, the natives had scooped up crude oil from huge pits, selling it mostly to Persians to lubricate their cartwheels, grease leather harnesses, and alleviate rheumatic pains. In the early 1870s, this primitive industry was suddenly thrust into the modern world when drillers struck wells of unprecedented force. Amid deafening roars, black geysers shot into the air with such staggering power that some of them couldn't be capped for months. One raging gusher spouted 2,400 tons of oil within its first 24 hours. In 1873, Robert Nobel, a member of the illustrious Swedish family, arrived in the Caucasus on a mission unrelated to oil. His brother had a contract to produce rifles for the Russian government, and Robert was scouting walnut trees for use as rifle stocks. Instead, he stumbled upon the bedlam of Baku, a frantic scene of such ghastly beauty that Maxim Gorky later limned it as a dark hell painted by an artist of genius. A crossroads as exotic as it was hellish, a Muslim enclave bristling with minarets, mosques, and palaces, Baku presented two faces to the traveler. In the bazaars, vendors hawked everything from Russian sugar to Persian silks, while outside of town a thick canopy of black smoke enveloped the refineries. Robert Nobel took his 25,000 rubles of walnut money and plumped it down to buy a refinery. Where local kerosene had hitherto been mocked as Baku sludge, the noble refineries produced kerosene equal to that of Standard Oil, which monopolized the Russian marketplace in the early 1870s. Bringing sophisticated management and ample funds to the industry, Nobel and his brothers had created by decade's end an 8-mile pipeline to the Caspian Sea, where they floated the world's first oil tanker, the Zoroaster. They pioneered a continuous refining method that was superior to Standard's batch system for sorting out distillates. In 1879, the Nobels organized the Nobel Brothers Petroleum Producing Company and soon cobbled together an impressive distribution system, complete with flat cars, tank cars, and storage depots, ejecting Standard Oil from Russia. That year, a roving Standard operative, William Brew, sent Rockefeller samples of Russian crude and refined oil, along with prophecies that in a few years, the Nobels would build a pipeline or railroad from the Caspian to the Black Sea, setting the stage for Russian oil to challenge Standard Oil in European markets. By the early 1880s, 200 refineries cluttered Baku's oil-stained slopes, and in 1883, true to Brew's forecast, a railroad connected Baku on the Caspian Sea to Batumi on the Black Sea. The potent Russian wells flowed with such fierce abundance that it was cheaper to produce oil in Russia than at Titusville, and cut-rate kerosene soon flooded European markets, undercutting Standard's prices. The American consul in Batumi, J.C. Chambers, who had been dispatched by Standard Oil to harvest intelligence, kept Rockefeller apprised of these developments and sounded an alarm about the Russians' quixotic ambition to drive the American oil from the markets of the world. Whatever the coolness between Rockefeller and American officialdom at home, they cooperated overseas to stop tariffs against American oil. Paying tribute to the State Department, Rockefeller later said, "Our ambassadors and ministers and consuls have aided to push our way into new markets to the utmost corners of the world." Rockefeller seems to have been caught napping by the Russian incursion, just as he had snuffed out all his major domestic rivals. When his Hamburg agent, Charles F. L. Meissner, reported in 1885 on extensive Russian penetration of European markets, Rockefeller, taken aback, fired off an indignant blast at his executive committee. "I am at a loss to understand how the bulk transportation could have been carried on to the extent referred to in Switzerland and elsewhere, without our having received more information about it." To retaliate, Rockefeller resorted to the usual high-powered weaponry, cutting prices across Europe and starting an insidious whispering campaign to question the safety of Russian kerosene. His files also reveal numberless secret contacts in Paris and London hotels, with shadowy self-appointed intermediaries inquiring whether Standard wished to buy a stake in Nobel Brothers or join with them in slicing up European markets. In 1885, Standard's peripatetic emissary, W. H. Libby, held talks with the Nobels in St. Petersburg, but these overtures faltered. The Nobels' power in Russia hinged on their relationship with the despotic Tsarist government, and they didn't intend to admit Standard Oil into their preserve. By the mid-1880s, another powerful force appeared on the world oil scene. The Paris Rothschilds, led by Baron Alphonse de Rothschild, had built refineries at Rijeka and Trieste on the Adriatic Sea. In organizing the Caspian and Black Sea Petroleum Company, better known by its Russian initials, Benito, they stood to reap a fortune from inexpensive Russian oil. No sooner had the Rothschilds entered the business than reports filtered back to Rockefeller that the Nobels, who were heavily in debt to the Rothschilds, could not meet their payments and might be forced to make common cause with the French bankers. For many years, the Rothschilds, the Nobels, and Standard Oil circled around each other, each trying to forge links with a second party to isolate the third. This vigorous competition abroad aroused Rockefeller's fighting spirit, and he even took to lecturing his colleagues in verse. "We are neither old nor sleepy, and must be up and doing with a heart for any fate, still achieving, still pursuing, learn to labor and to wait." Both Rockefeller and Archbold favored scrapping their former system of operating through European brokers and instead launching their own marketing subsidiaries. For a time, they were held back by Benjamin Brewster, and Rockefeller, unwilling to move without a consensus, yielded against his better judgment. When the Rothschilds set up a British oil marketing firm in 1888, Brewster's logic suddenly crumbled, and 24 days later Standard Oil set up its first overseas affiliate, the Anglo-American Oil Company, which soon monopolized the British oil trade. 2 years later, Standard started the Deutsche Amerikanische Petroleumgesellschaft in Bremen to handle the North German market. Neither old nor sleepy, Rockefeller set up an oil terminal at Rotterdam, struck a deal to supply all of France's crude oil, took stakes in oil firms in Holland, Italy, and Scandinavia, and orchestrated heating price wars in India. Taking a cue from the Nobels, Standard launched its first oil tank steamer to Europe, a mammoth vessel that transported 1 million gallons of oil, the first of what would shortly be an entire ocean fleet piloted from 26 Broadway. Despite the low price of Russian oil, Standard barred it from America and retained nearly 80% of world markets in the late 1880s. For all the complaints about adulterated kerosene that Rockefeller heard on his European travels, the Nobels and Rothschilds never matched the quality of Standard's products or surpassed its integrated operation. For Archbold, it was the Russians' failure to consolidate their domestic industry, that is, to suppress competition and establish a trust, that consigned them to secondary status. If there had been as prompt and energetic action on the part of the Russian oil industry as was taken by the Standard Oil Company, the Russians would have dominated many of the world's markets, which have been made to inure so largely to the benefit of the American oil industry. If the Nobels and the Rothschilds weren't mortal threats, neither did they capitulate tamely to Standard Oil, as so many American rivals had. These contending forces clashed repeatedly in the oil wars of the 1890s, a protracted battle that saw periods of blistering competition followed by cozy deals to divvy up markets. When competition forced price-cutting in the early 1890s, Rockefeller advocated a tactical rapprochement with his erstwhile foes and induced Baron Alphonse de Rothschild to visit 26 Broadway in secret. Archbold's report to Rockefeller about the July 1892 meeting revealed that beneath the competitive veneer, the Rothschilds were eager to come to terms with Standard Oil. "We reached a tentative agreement with them. I need hardly report again that it seems desirable on all sides that this matter be kept exceedingly confidential. It was thought best that we should not see the Nobel people, but that the approach be made to them on the subject by the Rothschilds. We were treated with great courtesy by Baron Rothschild, and we were much delighted that he spoke English fluently, which greatly facilitated our intercourse." In the end, Count Sergei Witte, the Russian finance minister, spiked the scheme for a grand alliance of Standard Oil with the Nobels and Rothschilds, to the dismay of countless European newspaper cartoonists who had made sport of evoking the clumsy embrace of the octopus and the bear. All the while, Russia kept pumping crude oil, and by the late 1890s briefly overtook the United States in oil production, even though Standard Oil handily eclipsed it in refining. By 1890, it was self-evident that oil existed throughout the Earth's crust, and that only a freak accident, plus some timely Yankee ingenuity, had led to the business being founded in Titusville. In 1884, Dutch drillers began prospecting for oil in Sumatra, and 6 years later received a royal charter to exploit Dutch East Indian reserves, christening their company Royal Dutch. Meanwhile, another aggressive contender waited in the wings. In 1891, the enterprising London merchant Marcus Samuel signed a contract with the Rothschilds to market their kerosene in the Far East. Samuel used the Suez Canal to speed the export of Russian kerosene to Asian markets. Oil had taken 4 months to travel from New York to the Far East, but now reached it from Batumi in a month. Even though Samuel designed a custom-made bulk tanker, the Murex, to conform to the canal's strict requirements, Standard Oil hired London solicitors to sow doubts about the project, spreading nasty rumors about a powerful group of financiers and merchants under Hebrew influence who planned to take tankers through the canal. Rockefeller later ranted against "our Asiatic competitors controlled by Jewish men who cry wolf, wolf, Standard Oil Company, and keep moving in and getting control of markets." He once compared Standard Oil's supposedly fair-minded methods with the old, old Jew method of treating one customer one way and another in another way. Warding off this verbal sabotage, Samuel managed to defeat Standard Oil decisively, and his trademark red oil cans, in contrast to Standard's blue cans, soon became known throughout Asia. By 1892, with oil production booming in Burma and Java, Standard Oil belatedly recognized the need for concerted action in Asian markets. It tried in vain to buy the business of both Royal Dutch and Marcus Samuel, who renamed his company Shell Transport and Trading Company in 1897 to honor his family's old seashell box business. Standard even stooped to trading for Russian kerosene in order to serve better its Asian customers. It finally set up a series of Asian stations and assigned a small army of agents to Shanghai, Calcutta, Bombay, Yokohama, Kobe, Nagasaki, and Singapore. These operatives sold Standard kerosene in tin cans with wooden frames, because Asian customers recycled the tin as roofing and turned the wooden cases into household objects. For all these smart marketing ploys, Standard Oil was forced to coexist with Royal Dutch and Shell, which merged to create a rival empire in the early 1900s. Henceforth, competition was enshrined as a permanent fact of the international oil business, despite a multitude of secret market-sharing deals, and it was only a matter of time before the deadly contagion of competition infected North America. Even as it was menaced by new competitors abroad, Standard Oil seemed omnipotent in American oil. Everything about its operation was colossal. 20,000 wells poured their output into 4,000 miles of Standard Oil pipelines, carrying the crude to seaboard or to 5,000 Standard Oil tank cars. The combine now employed 100,000 people and superintended the export of 50,000 barrels of oil to Europe daily. Rockefeller's creation could be discussed only in superlatives. It was the biggest and richest, the most feared and admired business organization in the world. Earning steady, reliable profits year in and year out, Rockefeller could be forgiven for believing he had outwitted the business cycle. For a man who craved order, he had reached his apogee. No longer at the mercy of unpredictable economic forces, he thrived even in recessions. Rockefeller was exceedingly pleased by the harmonious workings of his fantastic machinery and the neat, orderly unfolding of his days. When he arrived at work each morning, he sat at his roll-top desk and examined two stacks of paper, one representing decisions made, the other matters to be thought over, and he slowly burrowed his way through both piles. Starting in the 1880s, he adopted a policy of never doing business with strangers or even meeting them, avoiding unwanted solicitations and controversy. If this simplified his life, it also strengthened the unsettling image of an untouchable tycoon hidden behind the scenes. Many of Rockefeller's critics alleged that he divided his life into compartments and kept two separate sets of moral ledger books, one governing his exemplary private life, another sanctioning his reprehensible business behavior. But he saw his entire life guided by the same lofty ideals. In retirement, he wrote to Harvard President Charles Eliot, apropos of Standard Oil, "I can say without hesitation that no business organization with which I have ever been connected has been controlled by higher ideals." One way that he upheld this belief was to become self-righteous about his opponents, whom he reviled as undisguised rascals. The other people were up to all sorts of tricks, mixing benzene with the oil and so forth, he said of rival refiners. Nobody was more vigilant about being cheated than Rockefeller, nor quicker to seize the moral high ground. To convince himself that he was a highly ethical businessman, he redefined exactly what that meant. For instance, he always made much of the fact that he honored contracts, paid bills and debt promptly, treated small shareholders fairly, and never watered stock. To confirm his clean, sanctimonious image of himself, he reiterated these ideals with a kind of incantatory relish. And the more naysayers dwelled on his railroad dealings or secret subsidiaries, the more he affirmed his own compensating code of business honor. This was as much to preserve his own self-image as to persuade a skeptical public that he was honorable, for Rockefeller desperately needed to have a good opinion of himself. What further blinded Rockefeller to his misdeeds was that by the 1880s he always stood at several removes from any mayhem. He was now a master puppeteer, adroitly manipulating his marionettes, with the strings artfully concealed. As Standard Oil's leading figure, he was the only person who didn't have any direct operational responsibility. Instead, statesmanlike, he applied himself to general policy and monitored the performance of lieutenants, who sent him copious reports about their activities and often boasted shamelessly of their unsavory deeds. In contrast, Rockefeller replied in brief, opaque letters. He never assumed total confidentiality, even in internal memorandums, and cultivated a spare elliptical style, devoid of names or specifics, that would have baffled any prosecuting attorney. In creating this self-protective structure, Rockefeller could run Standard Oil while simultaneously sidestepping responsibility, erasing incriminating evidence, and avoiding contact with his victims. It enabled him to distance himself from the dirty work down below and feign ignorance of what was happening. When confronted with well-documented cases of terror tactics used by subordinates, he blandly conceded some few indiscretions by overly zealous employees and cast himself as a helpless spectator. But if one examines the reams of letters sent to him by his associates, his pose of innocence crumbles. He knew everything that was going on, and now, for the first time, we can document it. For that reason, we will digress occasionally in this chapter from the linear narrative of Rockefeller's life to examine reports he received from the field. They leave no doubt that he was the brains of the operation, directing activities he professed to deplore and setting the tone for his subordinates. This, of course, only complicates the mystery of how he integrated the various facets of his life, of how the enlightened patron of Spelman Seminary could also be the brutal overlord of Standard Oil. In the end, we can only explain how he rationalized his behavior to himself and others. Given the absence of revelatory letters or diaries, we can say little about the unconscious drives that led him to do this or the mental strains it might have caused. In his memoirs, Rockefeller implied that Standard took no rebates after 1880, whereas his files disclosed that collusion with the railroads became even more brazen after that date. By the early 1880s, the railroads had ceded supremacy in oil transport to the Standard-dominated pipelines, which now carried more than three-fourths of the crude oil from Pennsylvania wells to coastal cities, charging Standard Oil's own refineries half the posted price. Not surprisingly, as the railroads weakened, Standard Oil only browbeat them more. The Combine owned a subsidiary, the Galena Signal Oil Company, which monopolized the manufacture of high-grade railroad lubricants. Simply by stalling on shipments of this indispensable grease, it could bring any railroad to a halt. If Standard wished to extract a railroad rebate, it merely tacked on a surcharge to the price of Galena cylinder or engine oils. And Rockefeller continued to play his favorite trump card, the tank car fleet. By the late 1880s, Standard Oil was leasing its tank cars to 196 railroads, forcing most of them to pay a double mileage tribute to 26 Broadway, that is, a mileage royalty on outward-bound trips, when the cars were top-full of oil, and also on inward-bound trips when they returned empty. One reason for Rockefeller's continuing solicitude toward the roads after the pipeline revolution was that he himself had a significant investment in them. He conceded as much when he stated that Standard Oil stockholders, as the years had gone by, were becoming more and more a factor in railway problems and other enterprises. At the time, railroad shares were among the few blue-chip securities available to rich investors, which meant that Rockefeller invested heavily in the Erie, the New York Central, and other oil-carrying roads. In March 1881, Rockefeller wrote A.J. Cassatt of the Pennsylvania Railroad about rumors that his railroad would soon issue $400,000 worth of stock. He suggested they set up a joint private account of Pennsylvania stock, with Rockefeller making the payment. Whether this deal was executed is unclear, but it was a blatant bid to connive with a major railroad executive. In later years, when Ida Tarbell made railroad manipulation the focal point of her Standard Oil indictment, Rockefeller pleaded ignorance of such dealings, claiming they were handled by his colleagues, while he magisterially confined himself to broader matters. In fact, his papers document that he either met directly with railroad presidents or else was given graphic blow-by-blow accounts of negotiations by Flagler, Archbold, O'Day, Payne, Warden, and a formerly little-noticed figure, Colonel W.P. Thompson, who had headed a Virginia cavalry unit for the Confederacy. The secretary of Standard Oil of Ohio and a brother-in-law of Standard power broker Johnson N. Camden, Colonel Thompson shared a Cleveland office with Rockefeller and Payne, and his letters furnish explosive proof of extensive railroad collusion in the 1880s. While Rockefeller made it seem as if such shenanigans occurred far from his sphere, he was fully briefed by Thompson, who liked to boast of his maneuvers. Rockefeller's files are chock-full of examples of rebates well into the 1880s. In March 1886, William G. Warden reported from Philadelphia that the Pennsylvania Railroad had agreed to the following discounts. 52 cents per barrel to ship oil from Oil Creek to New York, versus a listed rate of 78 cents, and 39 cents to Philadelphia, versus 65 cents for other refiners. Rockefeller was always insistent that Standard's competitive advantage had nothing to do with preferential transport rates, but his correspondence reveals that rebates could single-handedly transform an unprofitable plant into a profitable one. In 1886, Colonel Thompson told him that it made sense to proceed with a new naphtha plant at Oil City. Naphtha was a crude oil fraction used to make gas or solvents. Only if the lake shore hauled the finished product to Cleveland for 10 cents instead of 17. During these negotiations, Colonel Thompson also reported that low freight rates would enable them to rehabilitate an otherwise insolvent Oil City refinery. Wherever possible, Thompson preferred oral agreements, once telling Rockefeller of his talks with two railroads, "I think they will concede the undesirability of a regular written contract." The backdoor deals with the railroads necessarily generated more speculation than proof at the time, but it was the Trust's marketing operation that ultimately proved its undoing, for it directly touched consumers and tens of thousands of small businessmen located in every congressional district. In the 1870s, Rockefeller began to assemble a marketing organization to eliminate the middlemen, independent agents who had earned 3 to 5 cents per gallon of kerosene. Since they handled Standard kerosene and competing products, an intolerable situation for Rockefeller, and often cared more about gouging consumers than expanding markets, he decided to get rid of them. Furthermore, Standard's refinery flow was now too huge to depend upon this fragmented, obsolete distribution system. Kerosene demand was booming as it illuminated mills, factories, hotels, and office buildings in the growing cities. To exploit economies of scale, Rockefeller noted, "We had to create selling methods far in advance of what then existed. We had to dispose of 2 or 3 or 4 gallons of oil where one had been sold before, and we could not rely upon the usual trade channels then existing to accomplish this. To have high-volume, low-cost production, the Standard needed huge guaranteed sales. This forced Rockefeller to integrate vertically the entire industry, controlling everything from the wellhead to the consumer." Around 1882, in a revolutionary development, the Trust began to sweep away the old distribution system, with its horse-drawn carts full of swaying barrels, and disperse millions of dollars to build thousands of tank wagons to service every American town. Rockefeller hailed the efficient new system. "I believe it one of our best means for getting and holding the trade." It worked thus. Standard's tank cars or pipelines delivered refined oil to storage tanks, where the tank wagons were filled up. From here, the wagons set out for local groceries and hardware stores, the principal retail outlets, where they replenished special canisters that the Trust provided. Sometimes, over the furious opposition of storekeepers, tank wagons even went door to door, selling directly to households and putting Standard smack in the retail trade. In some places, the trust manipulated local retailers by saying that they would refrain from this practice if storekeepers dealt exclusively in standard kerosene. The Combine also sold, almost at cost, heaters, stoves, lamps, and lanterns to widen the market. In the manner of a modern corporation, Standard Oil created demand as well as satisfied it, and its obliging agents helped consumers clean lamps and burners to enhance their use. Grocers and hardware merchants resented the demand to stock only Standard Oil kerosene or be starved out of the business. Along with wholesalers rendered obsolete by the standard marketing effort, they emerged as Rockefeller's most potent enemies. Conveniently, Rockefeller never set eyes on these men, had no sympathy for them, and chided them for standing in the way of progress. Of course it is natural that the man who drove the stagecoach should be antagonistic to the railroad, and that the man who used to keep the small inn should look with disfavor upon the big, magnificent hotels. Since jobbers often adulterated Standard Oil kerosene with poor-quality product from independent refiners, Rockefeller hoped that his marketing operation would ensure a uniform quality of Standard Oil products. The 1870s witnessed 5,000 to 6,000 deaths annually from accidents caused by faulty kerosene. Far from being immune to complaints, however, Standard Oil was bedeviled by reports that its kerosene emitted an offensive odor, crusted wicks, and smoked lamps. One day in Cleveland, an angry woman pushed her way into Rockefeller's office and demanded to know what he planned to do about his poor kerosene. Indignantly, he marched off to the lab and had the woman's sample analyzed, the results unknown. At 26 Broadway, he tracked the activities of the manufacturing committee, which burned kerosene lamps for 6 hours at a time to test oil quality. Always touchy about complaints, Rockefeller often blamed poor wicks and developed the Acme wick to eliminate those complaints. To his consternation, customers still grumbled even after they switched to this allegedly foolproof article. Standard's marketing subsidiaries were conducted with such controlled ferocity that they became the most hated part of the entire organization. One must recall that Standard Oil was a federation of companies, not a single firm, and held only a partial interest in many affiliated companies. This invited trouble, for Standard often retained the original managers and allowed them a fair degree of autonomy. When the Combine absorbed established marketing concerns, it brought into the organization several rogue proprietors who tarnished the Standard Oil name. Later on, Rockefeller feigned ignorance of their actions and disclaimed responsibility when, as we shall see, he received elaborate warnings about their methods. In 1873, Standard secretly bought half of Chess Carley and Company, which had a Louisville refinery and a lucrative marketing operation in the Southeast. The owner, F.D. Carley, was a lapsed Methodist minister who set a new standard for pitiless methods in oil marketing. Confidential reports informed Rockefeller that Carley was a charming scoundrel, an inveterate gambler who went straight from board meetings to his bookie's office. Even the circumspect Rockefeller referred euphemistically to Carley's want of balance. Although Rockefeller planned to pack Chess Carley's board with a majority of Standard directors, Carley blocked outright control from 26 Broadway until 1881, and another 5 years elapsed before Standard swallowed the firm whole and renamed it Standard Oil of Kentucky. By then, Chess Carley had become a byword for vicious tactics. When F.D. Carley learned that Standard Oil's nemesis, George Rice, had shipped a scant 70 barrels of kerosene to a Louisville merchant, he reacted furiously. As a director of the Louisville, Nashville, and Great Southern Railroad, which had granted Rice low freight rates, Carley had an underling dash off a peremptory letter to the railroad's freight agent, telling him exactly how to treat Rice. "Please turn the screw." When this quotation was revealed by investigators years later, it was emblazoned in newspaper headlines across America. Carley went to extravagant lengths to stop competitors. When he learned that Rice planned to sell kerosene in Columbus, Mississippi, He sent local grocers an unambiguous letter. "If you do not buy our oil, we will start a grocery store and sell goods at cost and put you all out of business." No bluffer, Carly set up a store that sold Standard Oil kerosene at cut-rate prices, as well as oats, meat, sugar, coffee, and other household items at or below cost. In many localities, grocers gladly took a 5% discount offered on foodstuffs by Carly in exchange for an agreement to carry only Standard kerosene, one of many anti-competitive practices perfected by Standard Oil that shaped future antitrust legislation. Notwithstanding the public uproar, Rockefeller claimed to be unaware of Carly's practices. Yet at one point, Colonel Thompson confidentially told Rockefeller that Carly was a secret surreptitious man with mysterious dishonest secrets who even cheated on his agreements with Standard Oil. In 1878, Standard Oil boldly expanded its marketing territory by acquiring a 40% stake in the Waters-Pierce Company,